Sue in this class. I don't know which Sue it was, but I want to thank you for reminding me to pull together these word studies in Genesis 1 that I've been promising week after week and forgetting week after week. We have them here today. Over there on the piano, we have copies for everyone. And I do know how this class works. We need 300 copies of every item to deal with the 80 that come here. So give them away to your friends and neighbors, etc., whatever you do with those things. So, but they're available now. And for those of you that are new in the class, we've been going through a course on science and the Bible, and right now we're into Genesis chapter 1, and going through that chapter. And the whole approach we're taking, at least in these first 11 chapters of Genesis, is to pick those pieces of those chapters that are the cause for the greatest doubt and skepticism on the part of secularists for taking the Bible as the error-free Word of God, and transforming those doubts into the strongest evidences that we can find for taking the Bible as the error-free Word of God, not just for faith and practice, but for science and history. And I say that because that's primarily the approach that many Christians take to these texts, is to say, well, they're accurate for faith and practice, but we don't need to look at them as a guide for science and history. We're taking the approach that they are a guide for science and history, as well as faith and practice. And then really, as you look at the text, you can't avoid the obvious references to the record of nature. The heavens do declare the glory of God, and that declaration is repeated here in these first 11 chapters of Genesis, as well as other texts that we look at. That's going to be our primary approach, to transform these strongest doubts into strongest evidences for the accuracy, complete accuracy, of this book we call the Holy Bible. Now, last time we left off with the second creation day. When you look at the first 2 days of creation, what we have here is God beginning to work on the surface of the waters. In the first verse, he's working in the heavens. He creates the entire heavens and earth, the stars, galaxies, matter, energy, and space-time dimensions, along which that matter and energy are distributed. But from verse 2 onwards, the focus of God's creative activities, at least from our perspective, would be events taking place on the surface of the waters below the cloud layer. Now, what we have in the first verse is God creating something brand new that never existed before. And that's brought out by the use of the Hebrew verb bara. You'll see that in your word study thing. You look up number 2 there. On the second page, you'll see it refers to this Hebrew word bara, which means to create something radically new, something brand new that did not exist before. It's extraordinary. It's supernatural in its context. But as we move into the first and second creation days, we see a very different word chosen. The text uses the verb haya, let there be. It's roughly similar to our English verb to be. God does not choose to use there the word bara, neither does he choose to use the word asa, which means to manufacture or fabricate, or the word that we see in Genesis chapter 2, yatsar, where God comes down and supernaturally works with the elements of the earth. Neither of those three words are chosen, rather the word asa, which means let there be. And so it's not referring to God radically transforming the earth. It's not referring to his coming down and supernaturally, personally working with the elements like he did with Adam. With Adam, he came down to the earth, and he took the mud of the earth and assembled, manufactured the body of Adam. And then he created within him brand new the spirit, the soul being there previously in the birds and the mammals. But that's not what we see here. It's simply the verb haya, let there be. So God does not create the light, neither does he create the water cycle. He says, let the light be, let the water cycle be. Well, why would God, yes? Well, ex nihilo is a Latin term. And it was a word or a phrase that was used by the early church fathers to describe what was going on in Genesis 1:1. What it means in Latin is out of nothing. So God created the universe out of nothing. It would be, as long as you understand what the text means by nothing. Okay, and when the early church fathers were writing about this, they didn't have the sophistication that we moderns have to recognize that there are different forms of nothing. You know, nothing was nothing for them. That was it. But for us, we have five different definitions of nothing that are in vogue. So you might want to follow that up and say, well, what kind of nothing is the text here referring to? Now, this particular text doesn't tell you, but there are other verses in the Bible that do tell you what kind of nothing we're speaking about. We've talked about this repeatedly in the class, so of course all of you can feedback and tell me what the five different definitions of nothing are, and which definition is referred to here in Genesis 1:1. Thank you for bringing this up. I just love to wake people up with these kinds of things, so let's go for it. First, what are the five different definitions of nothing? And by the way, don't be surprised if, say, 3 years from now, we have six different definitions of nothing. But right now, there are five that people worry about, whereas the early church fathers only worried about one. We have to worry about five.
Well, I can see one from your list
here.
Both
the empty
void,
one just... All right. Void. Now, what I'm going to get at is this. Nothing is a lack of something. Okay, that's a basic definition of nothing, a lack of something. Now, the way the early church fathers recognize it, something referred to everything they could possibly imagine. Today, we have distinctives. So, one definition would be a lack of X, another definition would be a lack of Y, another definition would be a lack of Z. Okay, go for it.
No dimensions?
Okay, a lack of dimensions. And we could break that down a little bit, couldn't we? Yes? Okay. All right. The lack of, you could say, the lack of length, width, height, and time. And matter and energy. That's one definition of nothing. So, and that's really what this text is referring to here. If you go to Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect was made from that which we cannot detect. So it was made from something, but it was made not from what we would recognize typically as something. When we think about something, we think of matter, energy, and the space-time dimensions along which it's distributed. So you got one definition. There are four more. A lack of something you're looking for. Okay, great. What are you looking for? She's looking for something. All right. What about this side of the class? I see a forest of hands over here. Yes.
I'll just take a guess because I haven't heard your definition, but I know it talks about making men, uses the word to make and also to create. So is it the Greek spiritual?
Yes, we will see the word bara again in the text. Now, you won't run into it to the fifth creation day. That's what's incredible about Genesis 1. You see it in the first verse. God creates something brand new that didn't exist before, literally creating something out of what we might call nothing. But we don't see it again until the fifth creation day, and we only see it once more on the sixth creation day. And one of those is references to human beings. And what is he creating brand new in humanity? The spirit. Okay?
But not the physical, because he also says
the physical was already there. So like the mud that he used to make the bodies of rabbits and cockroaches, that same mud could be used to make human beings, the bodies of human beings. But there was no spirit before on planet Earth. So God creates that brand new in man. We're going to get to all this. Okay. But she's on to something. What she's on to? Something. All right. I think I'm going to have to give that lecture again in our church on nothing. It's been a long time since we've talked about nothing. All right. Go for it.
Well,
Okay, very good. That's the first definition of nothing. Really simple. A lack of matter. Okay, no protons, neutrons, neutrinos, all that's missing. A lack of matter would be one definition of nothing. A second definition of nothing would be a lack of matter and energy. No matter or energy. This is the one that Einstein came up with special relativity. A lack of matter and energy. A third definition, the one that we had developed already. Okay, the lack of matter, energy, length, width, height, and time. However, if you read beyond the cosmos, you realize that physicists have discovered dimensional reality beyond length, width, height, and time. So a fourth definition would be? You can't perceive it, you can say that it's nothing. And the reason why we have these different definitions of nothing, we have different levels of perception. I mean, when you see an empty coffee cup, you might say, there's nothing in there, all right? And you're referring to the lack of matter inside the coffee cup. That's one perception. But there are different perceptions. Yeah, and, you know, there's heat in there. So there's energy inside there, even though there's no coffee in there.
That's what Jackie was talking about.
Right.
She said, there's something that you want or that you're looking for, and it's missing. It's
right. And you know, if you're really clever, you could just take this cup of coffee that somebody once drunk, you put a little thermometer in there and say, aha, it's warmer than the ambient temperature. There must have been something in there recently. All right? So, you know. All right. Now, the fourth definition of nothing, as you found in Beyond the Cosmos, was a lack of matter, energy, and 10 dimensions. All right? Yeah. When the universe was created, it was created with 10 space-time dimensions. And if you haven't read the book, those 10 dimensions are still here. They're everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's 6 dimensions curled up around our other 4. So, but a fifth definition would be a lack of matter, energy, and 10 space-time dimensions. And whatever else you might want to put within that realm, the angels live there. You might want to talk about the lack of angels. So, but you can't talk about the lack of God's presence. That's everywhere. In one sense, nothing doesn't exist. There's always something. See, we never really can talk realistically or rationally about true nothing, where there's absolutely nothing existing at all. Because God is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. So something's always around here. Something's always been here. Yes. Okay, number 4 was a lack of matter, energy, and the 10 space-time dimensions. Beyond that, you would have a lack of matter, energy, the 10 space-time dimensions, and whatever else that God creates within that realm. But, you know, we don't identify that because we haven't got, I mean, it could be angels and demons. Possibly they live in that realm. Possibly. We can't prove it. But they could. Okay? So, but we can't get at, you know, which what we often think of as absolute nothing, where nothing at all exists, because God has always been here. He pervades everything. Therefore, there's no such thing as that kind of nothing. But it's still useful to talk about nothing, because we're talking about a lack of something. Depends what that something is. Boy, do we get off the track here. All right. back into the first and second creation days, the text says, let there be. What God is doing is he's transforming the atmosphere of the earth and the interplanetary medium so that the light that was already created in the presence of the sun and the stars can now penetrate to the surface of the waters. Then we move into the second creation day, and it speaks about an abundance of water in the expanse or the sky above, and an abundance of water in the ocean below. I use the word ocean because there was only one ocean. That ocean encompassed the entire surface of planet Earth. There were no continents, there were no islands. The entire surface area was covered with water. So the ocean was everywhere. Now, yes. Would there have been ice caps at that point? I don't know. I don't think so, because we're looking at the planet with a very thick atmosphere at this point. Remember we talked about last week how there was this collision of a Mars-sized object with planet Earth that permitted the events of the first and second creation days? Because this is the problem that the first and second creation days present you with. You want a planet. Keep in mind, God begins with a planet. He says it's formless and void, empty of life and unfit for life. He wants life here on planet Earth. Eventually, he wants human life on planet Earth. And so we're going to need light for photosynthesis. We're going to need an adequate and stable water cycle. So it's necessary to somehow transform this planet to get an adequate water cycle with light available for photosynthesis. And as we discovered last week, this isn't going to work if you start with one planet. If you start with a planet, there's really no way you can design that planet to meet the conditions of the first and second creation days. If you give it the necessary mass that it needs, it winds up retaining far too heavy of an atmosphere. The bigger the planet, the more massive the planet, and the cooler its temperature, the heavier the atmosphere it will retain. And so you get planets like Mercury, which have virtually no atmosphere just because it's simply not massive enough. Its gravity's not strong enough. And it's far too close to the sun, so it's really hot. And, the escape velocity is such that virtually everything except argon and heavier gases evaporate to outer space. But then you move to Venus. Venus is a little bit further away from the sun, so it's more able to hang on to stuff. It's also much more massive than Mercury, and so it winds up with a very heavy atmosphere. An atmosphere with an atmospheric pressure that's more than 40 times what you experience here on Earth, roughly equivalent to what you get below 300 feet of water under the ocean, so very heavy pressure. And it's got this carbon dioxide mantle that makes the temperature of the surface of Venus about 800 degrees Fahrenheit. Enough to melt lead. Yeah, real toasty. And it doesn't cool off at night either. All right. So that's Venus. Now, we move up to Earth. And see, you want a planet with the gravity of Earth to hang onto the water. If it's not a little bit bigger than Venus, it will not have sufficient gravity to hang on to water. You also want it farther away. Well, Earth is farther away, but remember the rule of thumb. The farther you get away from the sun, the heavier the atmosphere. The more massive the planet, the heavier the atmosphere. So Earth should have been blessed with an atmosphere much thicker than Venus. And if it's much thicker than Venus, you can kiss the possibility of life ever existing goodbye. All right? Because we're going to wind up with a surface temperature even warmer than that 800 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not very pleasant for life. Not even the cockroaches can make it at that temperature. So we're out of luck. And also, you're not going to get a stable water cycle. It's going to be far too hot for water to exist. Remember one of the requirements for life? You want water in huge abundance, in liquid form, vaporous form, and an ice form, solid form. You need water in a huge abundance in all three forms if you want an adequate supply of life to support humanity. So if you begin with a planet, it just simply isn't going to work. You want a planet massive enough to retain water, you wind up with this very heavy atmosphere that spoils it in terms of it being able to retain water. So there's no way you're going to get the water cycle of the second creation day. Moreover, there's no way you're going to get the light coming through to the surface. So you're going to miss both opportunities. And the way it works, as we explained last time, is that the Earth had the blessing of a really dramatic collision 4.25 billion years ago. A planet the size of Mars, 9 times as massive as the moon, struck the Earth virtually in a head-on collision, And as a result of that collision, the Earth lost its primordial atmosphere. So that big, heavy atmosphere that it began with was blown off into outer space, which means light could now pass through. So light gets through. And then what happens is that because that collision took place as early as it did, at 4.25 billion years, not too early, not too late, the Earth had the opportunity to develop a secondary atmosphere. Now, if this collision were to happen too soon, it wouldn't work. Earth would wind up with a second heavy atmosphere. And if the collision takes place too late, the Earth will wind up with too thin of an atmosphere. At 4.25 billion years, you'll get an atmosphere of the thickness that's desirable for the support of life. So you have to time the collision at 4.25 billion years. You also have to make sure the object that collides is about 9 times more massive than the Moon. Because what you want from this collision is for the Earth to wind up with this very dense core. So it needs to have virtually a head-on collision so that most of this Mars-sized body gets absorbed into the core of the Earth. But with enough stuff being blown off from the collision, that you get the condensation of a lunar-sized object. And so as a result of this collision, the atmosphere gets blown off. You get this big cloud of debris above the Earth, which condenses to form the Moon. So it's 1/9 of what it started out to be. The rest of it gets absorbed into the core of the Earth. What does this do to planet Earth? Well, it raises its mass. Its mass now gets pushed up by about 8%, which makes it massive enough to hang on to this water so that you can have a stable water cycle for billions of years. Remember the problem we got here. Gravitationally, we want the Earth massive enough that it can hang on to water with a molecular weight of 18, but you don't want it so massive that you got a problem with ammonia and methane. Ammonia and methane are not nice for life, at least not in large quantities. A few belching cows is okay, but beyond that, you don't want a lot of this stuff sticking around. It's a greenhouse gas, for one thing. So, ammonia has a molecular weight of 17, methane of 16, and the Earth has the gravity and the chemistry in its upper atmosphere that it relatively quickly loses ammonia and methane, but it retains water. Water does not participate in this photodissociation process in our upper atmosphere, and gravitationally, the Earth has enough to hang on to water without hanging on to ammonia and methane. So a very delicate balance of a few percent is necessary here. It's important that the Earth's mass be raised by 8%. This collision raises it by that 8%. You get this nice big Moon. Yes. Okay, this is going to leave some impression on the Earth, to put it mildly. Okay, some have speculated that the Pacific Ocean Basin is that impression. Other geophysicists are skeptical of that by saying, look, 4.25 billion years is a long time. And the plate tectonics on the Earth is such that the continents get recycled every 100, 200, or 300 million years. And therefore, depression is not going to stay put for 4.25 billion years. A much more appropriate explanation for the Pacific Ocean Basin is a remnant of the breakup of the supercontinent that existed just 250 million years ago. You know, the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean Basin is only about 60,000 feet down. So, in that sense, I think it's more realistic, based on the plate tectonics, to say there is no mark. Now, there is a mark in this sense. The Earth does have a lot of plate tectonics. Where did it get all that plate tectonics? Well, most geophysicists attribute it to this collision. It was this collision, because one of the problems of planet Earth is this. How did it get its extreme density? Of all the planets in our solar system, planet Earth has the highest density. It has a density of greater than 5. I think it's about 5.6. And there's no other planet that has a density that high. And the scenario we're looking at here is this collision enriching the core of the Earth with heavy elements. Iron, nickel, cobalt, but also radioactive elements. These radioactive elements would filter up into the crust, and the heat from the decay of those radioactive elements is one of the primary driving mechanisms of that plate tectonics. The collision itself and the sloshing around of the liquid iron core would also contribute to the plate tectonics. And the truth is, there's no other planet, no other body in our solar system that's got anything close to the plate tectonics, the planet Earth. We are the earthquake champion of the solar system. By a wide margin, we are the earthquake champion of the solar system. Now, that's a good thing, too. I mean, if you read the last Facts and Faith newsletter, without that tectonics, we could not be here. We need that tectonics to make sure that carbon dioxide is retained in the atmosphere. Now, we'll be talking about on the third creation day how a lot of that carbon dioxide was taken out of the atmosphere. But you don't want it all taken out. And that'd be the problem, say, with a planet like Mars, is that carbon dioxide gets rained out of the atmosphere, absorbed into the crust, and because there are no plate tectonics, it stays there, it doesn't get back to the atmosphere. On planet Earth, however, it does. Yes, Tony. Okay, we can calculate the mass of the body that collided with the Earth to make what we see take place. It must be 9 times the mass of the Moon. All right, the Moon is 1/9 the mass of, 9 times the mass of the Moon. So, 1/9 of this stuff was retained in the Moon. What happened to the other 8/9? It was absorbed by the Earth. So, okay. How do you get that Mars-sized number? Is that what you're after? Why do we know it must be a Mars-sized object? Okay. Well, all it is, you take the Mars-sized object, subtract the Moon from it. What have you got left? And the dynamics tells us that most of it gets absorbed by the Earth. A tiny bit of it winds up in the Sun. But most of it winds up in the Earth. So that's the augmentation of the Earth's mass. So it's just simple subtraction. 9/9 minus 1/9. And you add that to the Earth and you're all set. The Earth is 9 times as massive as Mars. So that gives you the rest of the mass. There's another hand up here. Yes. Now, carbon-14 is useless for digging into this because carbon-14 has a half-life of only 5,700 years.
That's not what she's asking. I meant, is that radioactivity
that we got from that? Yes, but it would be from potassium-40, uranium-238, thorium. Well, you know, one science fiction novel that I've been exposed to many years ago had this as a scenario, that there were these creatures that invaded the Earth and wanted to take over the Earth. But we had nuclear weapons. They didn't. The reason they didn't, they came from a planet that didn't have uranium. And what the author was picking up on is how uranium-rich planet Earth is, and how rare that is in the solar system. One of the blessings of planet Earth is that it has a huge amount of these heavy radioactive nuclides. And this is not common in the rest of the universe. Well, number one, the solar system formed very close to a supernova eruption, which gave us an extra enrichment of iron and heavy elements. So the solar system itself is about twice as rich in those heavy elements as any other object that we can find in our galaxy. Our galaxy itself is extra rich in these heavy elements compared to other galaxies. And then of all the objects in our solar system, planet Earth is the richest of all in these heavy elements. So that's why this author was making this comment, is that if we're talking about elsewhere in our galaxy, chances are they're not going to have the blessing of these heavy radioactive elements like we do. And, you know, even if you're talking another solar system body, it's not going to have the riches that we do. And the amazing thing is, it's up there in the crust. And again, that's thanks to this event. So, all right. So we may be the only ones in the entire universe that has the ability and the blessing of making atomic and hydrogen bombs. Isn't that wonderful? So, but there are other things. I mean, iron, for example, is a necessary nutrient for many forms of life. And iron, of the quantity that we see on planet Earth, is really rare. Earth has the richest abundance of iron. I mean, 5% of the Earth's crust is iron. And you'd be hard-pressed to find anything else in the universe with a richness of that degree. Yes. Very good. All right. It was this event that blessed the Earth with this liquid iron core. And because of that liquid iron core, we have a strong, stable magnetic field. And because of that strong, stable magnetic field, we have Van Allen belts. So what do you need these Van Allen belts for? To keep other stuff out, right? It's a radiation shield. Again, you could go back to these science fiction things. They talk about these force fields and these shields that they have. Well, we have one. Earth is blessed with a force field that protects us from being zapped by soft X-rays. And you say, well, why do we have the soft X-rays? Because of the sun. The sun's pouring out huge quantities of these soft X-rays. And if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here. We need the sun. We need a star the size of the sun in order to survive. If the sun were any bigger or any smaller, we couldn't survive. We explained that in, we did that a year ago in the course here. You all remember that lecture we had and why the sun has to be exactly the size that it must be. Okay, I'll refer you back to that. It's covered in the Creator and the Cosmos. But because of that, we have this wash of X-rays. But we are protected from those X-rays because of the Van Allen belt. And this is something NASA is well aware of. It's one thing to have a space station orbiting Earth, because it's going to gain some protection from that Van Allen belt. Not as much as what we get here on the surface, but nevertheless considerable protection. But once you start talking about sending men to the moon or to Mars, you're away from that shield. And now you've got a much more difficult problem. This is why NASA is talking about having spaceships with a lead room where the astronauts can go in times of radiation storms. But now they have to deal with the psychological problem of having a bunch of people living in a tiny little lead room for months on end. Whether you can handle that claustrophobia, I don't know. EPA probably wouldn't like the lead anyway, so you've had your hand a long time. I'll get to you, Kathy, in a sec. Go ahead. Okay, good question. How do we know that we're so blessed with these heavy radioactive elements? Yeah, this stuff is easy to see. You just get your little telescope out there, you put a spectrometer in the back end, and you look for the spectral lines of uranium, thorium, potassium, 40, etc. And so, well, it's not that easy, actually, but it is somewhat routine to get your telescopes out there, take these spectral photographs, take a look at them, and it tells you not only what elements and molecules exist on different heavenly bodies, but the abundances of those. Now, there's a theoretical check on this too. We know the age of the universe, and we know what happens to stars as they burn. They produce these heavy elements. We can calculate how much, through nuclear burning, of these heavy elements we'd expect in different parts of the universe or a galaxy after so many billions of years. And those numbers tell us that we should have a much lower level of these heavy elements than we see here on planet Earth. So, and the observations verify what our nuclear physics tells us that we should expect. You get the same number. So there's two ways to check it. You get the same answer both ways. Kathy.
Well, Neil and I are still back on this one question about how we know, how was it determined that this object that crashed into the Earth was, density or size, the mass of this
star? Why do we know it must be Mars size? Didn't we cover that here in the class? I thought maybe I could throw that back to you and ask you. No, I'll do it. Yeah, you remember, don't you?
I don't know if I remember or not, but it just seems from logical, if it's the same size as the Earth, it would probably destroy both of them. It's a huge crash. It's too small. It's too small. You said this. If it's too small, it won't blast the Earth off. It won't get apart to keep the Earth away from the Earth.
So it's a theoretical.
Yeah, it's a theoretical calculation. I mean, we have no observations to verify this other than the fact that we can date the collision. We can date it by looking at the cratering of the moon and realizing the oldest craters are only 4.25 billion years. Also, they brought back moon rocks, and they were able to subject those moon rocks to radiometric dating that came out to 4.25 billion years. Yeah, looking at the oldest moon rocks, that tells you when the moon formed, and it's a lot younger than the Earth, or significantly younger than the Earth. It's also chemically distinct from the Earth, so we know it had to come not from some primordial Earth. It couldn't have split off from the Earth. It must have been a later event, a collision event. So we know that. But yeah, how do you get the fact that it must be 9 times as massive? We know the mass of the moon. So you can run through the physics and say, all right, what massive body do we need colliding with the Earth to get a lunar-sized object? Because that's the goal. You want a large, single moon. And actually, the math is quite definitive. You know to about 2 places of the decimal the mass of the object colliding with the Earth that's necessary to give you a single large moon of the density we see. Another check on is we know how fast the moon is spiraling away from the Earth. That also factors into the mass calculation. So it all comes out. So with a fair degree of certainty, we can tell you what the mass of the object was. All right, you're next.
Now, is this then Genesis 1:1 where the two
pieces of the thing were created at once? No. Genesis 1:1 is in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, the entire physical universe. That would include the stars, the galaxies, the matter, the energy, the space-time dimensions. This happened later. Okay. Yeah, Genesis 1:1, we're looking 15.5 billion years ago. Now we move to Genesis 1:2. The Spirit of God is brooding on the surface of the waters. Well, the Earth is only 4.59 billion years old. So the Spirit of God must have been brooding on the surface of the waters a little bit after that 4.59 billion. And then we get into the second creation day. We're talking an event taking place subsequent to 4.25 billion years. So that's kind of the time frame we're working in as we go through.
Sort of there in Genesis 1 and 2. Or, I mean, it set up the conditions.
Well, it can't be any earlier than 4.25 billion years because the atmosphere that we need for water above and water below, huge quantity of water in the atmosphere above and in the oceans below, that takes some time to form subsequent to the collision. Now, we got some rough ideas how much time it takes, but the moon has got to be fairly well away from the Earth before you're going to get that stable water cycle. And, yeah, Glenn Ellen.
It
Okay, what comes through the calculations? What you're probably saying is right, that the object that hit the Earth must have been heavy metal rich. But in addition to that, the collision itself would enrich the density. because the light stuff gets stripped off. The heavy stuff is what gets absorbed into the core of the Earth. So it would be rich and probably for two reasons rather than just one reason. But because of that, we get this magnetic field. We get protection from X-rays. You're going to need that. It's pointless to have this nice, stable water cycle if the radiation makes life impossible on the surface of the water. So you got this magnetic field, which sets everything up. I'm going to give you the whole list, and you can ask all your questions, all right? Because I've been trying to give you the whole list for 3 weeks now and never been able to quite get through it. Okay, number one. We get rid of the oppressive high greenhouse effect atmosphere. So this high pressure, high greenhouse effect atmosphere is removed so we can have a temperature appropriate for life. It gives the Earth sufficient mass that it can retain water for a long period of time. It gives the Earth the tectonics that's necessary to retain carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We get this strong magnetic field, which sets up a Van Allen belt, which allows us to gain protection from X-ray radiation, some other nasty stuff. And we also wind up with this giant single moon. I mean, the moon is 2,400 miles in diameter. The Earth is 7,900 miles in diameter. So as we've mentioned here before, what we're really looking at with the Earth-Moon system is the equivalent of a double planet rather than a planet and a moon. Again, the gravitational dynamics of the solar system is such that no planet can form out of its primordial mass a moon any bigger than 1% of the mass of the planet that it starts with. And so we have this huge moon next to this small planet. So it's really not a true moon. But because of that giant moon, let me finish, then we'll let you ask all your questions. This is my last one. Okay, I got one more after this. But okay, because of this giant single moon, the orbital axis, or pardon me, the spin axis of planet Earth is stabilized. We're at a nice 23.5 degrees. And without this giant single moon, the tilt of the axis would wobble from 0 to 90 over the course of millions of years. And indeed, that's what's happening to all the other solar system bodies. The rotation axis wobbles all over the place. And if that were the case, you could not have stable climates. And by the way, 23.5 degrees is the ideal tilt to maximize the diversity and quantity of life on planet Earth. If it was exactly 0 degrees, it'd be too hot at the equator and too cold at the poles. But because it's 23.5 degrees, you maximize the temperate zone over the whole surface of the Earth, and indeed our planet is such that you can have life over the entire surface of the planet. Maybe least able in the South Pole, but even life exists down there. But if the tilt were anything other than 23.5 degrees, I mean, if you get it, say, at 40 degrees, then you got one part of the Earth facing the sun for too long of a period of time, whereas the other part doesn't, and that's going to make one part of the planet too cold, one part too hot. Amazingly, you get the most temperate temperatures for the whole surface of the planet at 23.5 degrees. You can say, well, God could just stick it at 23.5 degrees. He could. And he did that. But you have to keep it at 23.5 degrees. And now with that giant single moon, it can be kept at that 23.5 degrees. All right. But we need the moon for other reasons. You need it to slow down the rotation period. Because of the tidal interaction. Remember that little lecture we had on tides? Anybody come want to explain it again for the benefit of the rest of the class? You can come up here and do it. No, you don't want to do that. But it is explained, I think, in the Fingerprint of God. We threw it in there. But because of this giant moon, we have strong tides. One of the impacts of those strong tides is it slows down a rotation period. And so when the moon was first formed, we're looking at a rotation period of about 6 or 7 hours a day. Today it's 24 hours a day. You can have life on planet Earth at 8 hours per day. Primitive life, unicellular life. If you want human beings, cows, pigs, and horses, you got to wait till it's about 24 hours a day. So that kind of explains the whole fossil record thing. Another blessing is that those tides enable a wide diversity of life forms on the coasts. And one of the things that paleontologists have pointed out is that the coastal regions of the Earth seem to be those places that spawn this incredible diversity of life. Why? Because the tides bring nutrients in every day to these shallow coastal areas. They also take away waste products every day. So those tides are kind of a cycle, bringing nutrients in and taking waste out. And all that is thanks to the moon. The other blessing is the moon sets up the miraculous events of the fourth day of creation. Because what happens on the fourth day? The atmosphere is cleared, where it becomes not just translucent, but transparent. The moon factors into that as well. And we need this collision and the moon to make sure that we get not just the first and second creation days, but the fourth creation day as well. This is not a complete list of all the blessings of this incredible collision, but it's the most significant events for life that we see here on Earth. Now, any questions? We still got questions. I thought this would take care of it all. No, it didn't. The Big Bang is Genesis 1-1. The collision's got nothing to do with the Big Bang. This is the minor bang, the mini bang, all right? Okay, Genesis 1-1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, the entire physical universe. The heart of the Big Bang theory is the universe having an origin out of which all the matter, energy, space and time explodes from. And so the universe was created by God, encapsulated in this near infinitely small volume, near infinitely dense volume, and then expands outward from that. And it's still expanding to this day. So we're still in the aftermath of the Big Bang creation event. What we're describing here with planet Earth and the moon is just some little tiny vortex in this huge Big Bang event. So, taking place billions of years later. Yes, Mel. Okay, good question. What Mel is bringing out here is that what the geophysical research tells us is if you go really early into Earth's history, there is no atmosphere, no oceans. How do you get the oceans in the atmosphere? Well, keep in mind the Earth is formless and void. It means it's rather well mixed. But as the Earth is cooling out of the solar nebula, pockets of gas that are embedded in this primordial Earth begin to bubble up to the surface. And that's where the atmosphere and the oceans come from. Then, several hundred million years later, the Earth experiences this collision with this Mars-sized object, and this dissipates into outer space, this atmosphere, and a large chunk of that ocean. Now, one thing that comes through the dynamics is a lot of the water that gets thrown out comes back. But a lot more water is produced through the second bubbling up. See, by taking place of 4.25 billion years, there's still quite a bit of gas trapped below the surface of the Earth. This is still bubbling, still going on today, by the way. That gas interior to the Earth makes contact with the surface and enriches our atmosphere. And some of those volatiles will be water, so it contributes to the ocean. But the effect today is minuscule compared to what was going on in the early history of the Earth. That's why I made the comment, you want the collision to take place at just the right time. Because here's all this gas bubbling up to the surface, and the collision takes place too early, there's still lots of gas trapped inside the Earth that would make an atmosphere and an ocean that's bigger than what you want. But if it takes place too late, you wind up with too thin of an atmosphere and too small of an ocean. But timing at 4.25 billion years gives us the atmospheric and oceanic conditions that are ideal for life. So that's roughly how it works. But yeah, if you go back to 4.59 billion, there's no atmosphere there at all, or ocean. That takes time. But that tells us that the Spirit of God must have been brooding a little bit later than 4.59 billion years. Yes? I've never heard it said that way before. All right. God threw a strike right over the plate, and if you're as old as some, you can reject to a Sandy Koufax analogy. I've heard some of them suggesting Oral Hershiser. I'll have to talk to my sons as to who they would go for today. I don't know. They don't even know who Sandy Koufax. Isn't that incredible? Yes.
Now, with the atmosphere layer present at this 4.5 billion years ago.
Yeah, if we're talking 4.5 billion, you've got an atmosphere in place. Doesn't take long for that atmosphere and ocean to form. 4.59 billion, but by 4.50.
Okay, let's try 4.5.
All right.
Now we don't have either layer.
Okay. Yeah, the solar system's still forming at that point.
Mass of the Earth before the collision is a bit less than it was after.
Right.
So the gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't we boiling this stuff up? All of it, water, oxygen, why are we boiling the water off like crazy at that point? We reached the escape velocity.
No. I mean... Okay, what's keeping the water on the Earth when it's forming?
As the ocean is forming, what's keeping the water on the Earth?
A gravity and a low temperature. That's all you need to figure out what's retained. The escape velocity of a molecule... Well, yeah, the sun's cooler, remember. The sun's not putting on as much heat as it is today. But the greenhouse effect is much higher. Well, the temperature would have a gradation from the surface up to the top. So, I mean, we were talking about the Earth today with an atmosphere that it had back then. We're looking at a surface temperature, I would guess, in excess of 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. But if you put it back then, you get different numbers. And that's the surface temperature. I mean, to get rid of the water, you're going to need to have a high temperature fairly high up in the atmosphere. That will get rid of the water. And yeah, the Earth might have been losing a fair amount of water early in its history. But water is very abundant in the universe, very abundant in the solar system. What God wants is a certain amount of water to exist at, say, 4 billion years and thereafter. So, in the very beginning, there could have been a lot more water. A lot of that water might have been dissipating. But then a lot comes back, too. Because Earth is able to grab water that's out there. Yes?
Some of the oldest of them, 40 years ago. My general impression is that our understanding of the whole process is vastly different than what it used to be. The Earth is now.
Even 10 years ago.
The best part of this message, how much different is it likely to be 10 years from now or 20 years from now?
Okay. I was first exposed to this about 40 years ago myself, although I didn't get it in school. That was that we have no answer. If you look at any textbook previous to the Apollo astronauts, that's what you'll see in those textbooks. We have no answer to explain the moon. We can explain everything in the solar system except the moon. So it was a big unanswered question back in the old days. But subsequent to the Apollo astronauts, and really this came out about 10 or 12 years after they brought back the lunar rocks. It took them quite a bit of time to do the proper analysis on those rocks to figure what was going on. And that's when they happened onto this collision. You say, well, why didn't they happen onto this collision earlier? It was such an improbable event, they said it couldn't have happened that way. Okay, when they were working out collision scenarios when I was a kid, what it was one planet coming near planet Earth and shearing a piece off that became the moon. And they said, well, that won't work. Then they had a planet colliding with the Earth, and they said, that won't work because the Earth gets destroyed. What they didn't think about was a smaller body colliding with the Earth and then forming the moon from accretion. Nobody worked that out because they said, that's just so impossible statistically, it's not even worth thinking about. Let's deal with the more probable collision scenarios. Well, the more probable collision scenarios just didn't work. So what did the textbooks tell you? I got textbooks at home I can show you. I just closed it with saying the moon is our biggest unsolved mystery in solar system astrophysics. But today's textbooks don't call it an unsolved mystery. They say, you know, we know that it's this way. And what gave them the confidence? Well, when they figured out that the moon was a different age and different chemical composition, that immediately told them it had to be some kind of collision scenario. So what was considered to be previously so improbable that it's not worth doing research on, they said, we're forced to do the research on it. It must be this path. And they worked out the numbers, and the rest of the story is now in all the textbooks. I don't think any of it's going to be significantly changed in subsequent years. Now, the details, there's going to be a lot of refinement, because this model is still being worked out.
Just out of curiosity, what is the textbook now? What are the unknown?
Yeah, what are the great mysteries that we can look forward to being solved in the next few years? Well, we've been trying to give you little bits and pieces of that, and facts and faith, and the creator and the cosmos. I think the next big breakthroughs are going to come about in... We'll figure out which of the inflationary hot Big Bang creation models is correct. There are about 40 of them competing for attention now. And we have enough science to realize that one of them is probably correct, or maybe we need to refine the ones we have to get something better. But the good news is that we should have a definitive answer probably by about the year 2004 at the latest. What's going to happen then? We're going to have maps of the distribution of galaxies in a universe that are accurate enough that we can compare with the theoretical models. Because that's really the determining factor. When do galaxies form, and how clumpy are the galaxies in the universe? If we know those two figures, when the galaxies form, what kinds of galaxies formed at what epochs, and what the true distribution of the different kinds of galaxies are, we can give you far more detail on the creation event than we can today. So that's coming. And the real definitive maps are promised to be published in the year 2002. So given two more years to work out the calculations, 2004, we should have an article ready for Facts and Faith, right? All right. Gravitons, that could be another big breakthrough. I'm not so hopeful about our discovery of gravitons. With the current instruments that we now have, the current instrument isn't built yet. The year 2000, we're going to have the first operable gravity wave telescope. We've had gravity wave telescopes before, but they were so incredibly insensitive, they couldn't have picked up any kind of gravitational event. Nothing. We now have a telescope powerful enough that can pick up gravitational events, but they have to be exotic events. A head-on collision between two neutron stars will be detectable. But how often do two neutron stars experience a head-on collision? Well, nobody's ever seen one. And if you talk to astronomers and say, well, statistically, what are the chances of getting one? Well, could be a long wait. So, but there is one binary neutron star we're watching that we know will collide. So, we observe it for a little longer, we'll be able to calculate when it would collide. My guess on that is it's going to be in the thousands of years, not the hundreds of years. So all that tax money you poured into that gravity wave telescope, it could be a while before we see any significant return. Yes, Kathy? Probably, but let me tell you what the unknown questions are still outstanding on this collision. What we don't know at this point are what factors determine how rapidly this newly formed moon spirals away from the Earth. Now, that's significant because the rate at which the moon spirals away from the Earth determines how rapidly the Earth spins down from, say, 6 or 7 hours to 24 hours. So if we knew what exactly was responsible for the rate at which the moon moves away, then we could probably answer your question. But one of the things we do know, that must be designed. You know, that must be factored in. The moon must spiral away at a certain rate or things aren't going to work for life here on planet Earth. That's if you want intelligent life here on planet Earth. You must have the moon spiraling away at about 6 centimeters a year. Oh, you can measure it every year. You know, we got those little laser reflectors up there, and we can actually determine how rapidly that moon is moving away. I think the number is about 5.9 centimeters per year that it spirals away from the Earth. Well, no, we can extrapolate that back in time, and that tells us things like how fast the Earth was rotating billions of years ago. Remember that book I gave you on differential calculus for Christmas? Right. What that book will tell you is this. If you know the rate at which it's moving away today, you can calculate where the moon is all the way back in time and how fast the moon was moving away at different points.
You said we didn't know that.
Yeah, we don't know why. Okay, what we don't know are exactly what kind of dynamics you have to build into the collision to guarantee a relatively rapid formation of the moon, a moon so that it begins to move away from the Earth at 5.9 centimeters per year. We know it's 5.9. We also know that 5.9 is critical for the diversity and the complexity of life here on planet Earth. But what do you have to build into that collision exactly to guarantee you wind up with that 5.9 centimeters? That's still an unsolved problem. That's something that is... It's complex, and we have the potential for solving that problem. That might be something where we can write an article for you in Facts and Faith in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. I don't know. Yeah, Tony. There are some variations built into that. So, you know, the moon does wobble around a little bit, but basically it's dragged with the Earth. Now, the Earth has a much more profound impact on the moon than the moon has on the Earth. So, the tidal forces on the moon are, you know, far greater than what we experience here on Earth. I mean, the tides of the moon are able to move water and to move air, but the tides of the Earth on the moon are able to move solid rock. So the moon is bulged up by 150 feet on the near side compared to the far side. And that's one of the things we've seen about the tidal thing. The tides of the Earth on the moon are so strong that it's forced its rotation period to be identical to its revolutionary period relatively quickly. know, initially the moon would have had a very different rotation period than its revolutionary period, but it could only resist the tidal forces of the Earth for so long, and it became riveted. Incidentally, that will inevitably happen to the Earth as well. The tides of the moon are strong enough to one day force the rotation period of the Earth to be identical to the orbit of the moon about the Earth. That will happen. When? 40 billion more years. That will take place. And that's exactly the dynamics that's working. The moon is working on the Earth to bring the rotation period of the Earth in line with the revolution of the moon about the Earth. So they're now out of whack. The moon's 29 days, the Earth is 24 hours. But the tidal forces are bringing those into synchronism slowly but surely at a rate of a few microseconds per year. Yes. Right. That's correct, Dave. That's absolutely correct. And that's, you know, because we wouldn't expect from the gravitational dynamics that the Earth before that collision would have a rapid rotation period. But you're right. I mean, you get this head-on collision, and we wouldn't expect it to be exactly head-on. It'd be a little bit off-center. That little bit off-center is where the Earth gains a lot of angular momentum. So it would have been spun up very rapidly, rotating just every few hours. But with the formation of the moon, and now we have a break set on that rotation period, and it goes from a few hours down to our current 24 hours. We wait a few hundred more million years, we'll have a 25-hour rotation period instead of 24. All of you who want more time in your day, you will eventually get it. It's coming. Every year. Maybe you've noticed that. I mean, somebody came up to me this morning and said, you know, the older you get, the faster time seems to go. Well, the truth is, it's the other way around. Every year, it gets a little bit longer than the year before, but a few microseconds probably aren't that noticeable. Tony?
Even if the weather's dead center collision, you suddenly have more mass with the same angular momentum. So the new object starts
rotating. Even if it's dead on. If it's dead on, you probably are going to get the thing splitting into a couple of pieces. So you got to be careful. Wanted to be a little bit off. A little bit off, then the dynamics work quite well. Yeah, right. I'm just saying you're probably going to get more dramatic effects with the Earth if it's that kind of scenario. Okay, any more comments? Boy, we actually made it through the second creation day. How about that? Well, one of the things I think we can draw out of all this discussion, if you get through the first 2 days of creation, I mean, look at the text in the English, in the Hebrew, and it's just, let there be, let there be. Well, I guess God's just letting the solar system run its natural course. What we're describing here is not exactly a natural course. The probability of this all happening by chance is so remote that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, physicists looking at this said, this is just so incredible, we're not even going to discuss it. This is such a small possibility that for us to say this is how the moon formed, it's equivalent to saying it's a miracle. Obviously, we're not going to do that. And so they said, it's just a big mystery. We don't know how it happened. So that explains what the language of the textbooks 20, 30 years ago. They preferred to call it a great mystery rather than call it a miracle. Well, I got one textbook at home written by a Norwegian, and he's an atheist. But in that textbook, he calls it a miracle. Now, he's writing 1966. He says, the probability of this moon forming is so utterly remote that we might as well call it a miracle.